Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 276, and we're gonna talk about that thing I've been really trying not to talk about, but now I have to talk about, and that thing is the popo, the cops, the police. We're also gonna talk about what happens if you're driving and your alternator dies. Should you stop immediately? Are you stuck? What should you do? And we'll have a product review of a device that Hal said I should get, and I resisted, and I got it, and you know what? Hal was right. So there you go, Hal. You were right. And I'll explain why when we get to that segment. But first, I have to thank everyone for reaching out after last week's episode. A number of you have offered to step up and help do some episodes and other content stuff, and I appreciate that. I will be in touch. If you haven't heard from me yet, don't worry. I've made a list. I'm going to send you guys like a package and information and stuff. Thank you. And thank you also to everyone else who wrote and said, hey, maybe you should just kind of end the podcast on a high note. But I think I gave too negative a tone last week. I am not eager nor trying to end the podcast. I'm just trying to face reality. I am absolutely going to continue up through episode 300. If I can, I want to keep going till episode 500. When I originally started the podcast, my original goal was 1,000. I would really like it if I could make it that far. But I'm in a place now where I can't promise it. So I'm promising up to 300 and asking for some help that maybe will make it more likely that I can get beyond 300. But nothing is going to change for the time being. But I do appreciate everyone reaching out and offering their input, which is what I've asked. And you can still do that at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Okay. I started recording an episode about this a few weeks ago, and then I said, no, I don't know enough about this to talk about it, and then now I feel like I have to. And I just spent half an hour talking about this to the ether, apparently, because my software failed me and it didn't record any of it, which is probably good, because the second time you record things is always better, actually. And even if it isn't, I'm going to keep believing that, because that will give me the motivation to keep going and not just hang my head in despair. We got to talk about the cops. So when I started this podcast, I decided I was going to be a cheerleader for people who want to do van life. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to tell you the way it is. I'm going to say, you know, pooping in a bucket isn't for everybody. But if anyone wanted to do it, I wanted to give them all the encouragement in the world and everything I could offer to help them try this thing out, whether it worked or not, whether they were a van lifer for a weekend or for the rest of their lives, didn't matter to me. And I am still that person. I am encouraging. But unfortunately, I feel guilty about it now, and I don't like that. And the reason I feel guilty about it is because when I started doing this in 2019, the world, and I mean the United States mostly, was a different place. And I feel like things have changed a lot. And I don't think it's safe out there. It's pretty safe. It's not completely safe. And I think I need to devote this time to explaining my new thoughts on the police and interactions with the police and how to think about the police. Because some of the things I said in the past, I maybe don't believe anymore. What I used to say was, if you stay in rest areas, you're fine. If you do get the knock, you can just explain that you're sleepy and that you're going to leave by a certain time. And more likely than not, that's going to be it. The cops are going to just say fine, and they might roll back around and see if you left or not. All they care about is that you're not like living there. And they're interacting with you just to check it out to see if there aren't beer cans laying all over the place and stuff like that. I mean, that was what I thought was going on. And I think that was probably true. Now I am less sure of that. And that is especially true if you're not a white person. I've been aware of the concept of driving while black for decades. So I'm not that naive. But things are different. That's not what I'm talking about. We live in a country now where it is completely legal for masked men, kinda sorta dressed like police, but with no badges or badge numbers, to detain you, handcuff you, pull you into a van or other rented SUV, and drive you away based solely on one or two of two things: the color of your skin and your accent. That might sound crazy, but it's actually true. ICE, the immigration folks, who are now one of the largest armed forces in the world due to funding, can just simply say, that person over there looks Hispanic, and just grab that person and take them away. And then it's up to that person to prove that they're in the country legally or not. That is, I believe, unconstitutional. Unfortunately, I am not a judge, and so far the judges have held that that is constitutional, at least for now. We'll see how it goes down the road. But that means that everything I've ever said to you, if you're an Hispanic person or you kind of look Hispanic, kind of doesn't apply, because a knock on the door now could mean that you're going to spend the next day in some cell somewhere, and your van's going to be towed away and thoroughly searched. And maybe you were in Chicago and had some marijuana in Chicago, which is completely legal, but maybe you got stopped in Kansas, where it's not legal, and suddenly that's a problem that they never would have known, except that they pulled you over or stopped you at a rest area because you happen to have a brownish tinge to your skin. It's a problem. And I don't know what the solution is, honestly. I mean, the solution isn't something that an individual can do. Add on top of that all the new anti-homelessness laws, including from the federal government, where basically by executive order, it is illegal to be homeless. And van lifers are on pretty shaky ground when dealing with the police now. Basically, they can do whatever they want, and there's not much you can do. And while I have never had a terribly bad interaction with police, there have been a few that I've not thought highly of. Most of them have been because I was breaking a law. I was speeding in most cases, and I got pulled over, and I maybe got a ticket or maybe didn't. I mean, okay, that's how it works, you know? I knew I was taking this risk, and everything was fine. But I know that a lot of other people have had completely different experiences, and often it seems to be more with people who aren't white that are having these problems. And more often. Now, it absolutely, definitely is. There's no question. So all the advice I ever said about stealth camping and, you know, you're probably going to be okay, and, you know, just do this and they'll... That's all out the window. I can't say that anymore. If you are stealth camping, and by that I just mean camping, sleeping overnight in your van someplace that isn't a designated camping area, you're taking a risk. And that risk is arrest. You can be arrested for that, whether you're doing anything wrong or not, or even whether you're doing anything legal or not, because the laws right now are so all over the place that all a cop has to do is think that maybe you're kind of sort of doing something illegal, and they'll arrest you until it can get figured out, and they'll leave it up to a district attorney, to figure out whether they want to prosecute you or not. It doesn't matter. It's the cop's decision whether they're going to haul you in. It makes me very, very sad to say that, but when I look back on my van life experience and all the places I have slept all over the country, parking lots and Cracker Barrels and Walmarts and Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's and a couple of hotels, a supermarket, I mean, a whole bunch of different places. I've slept just on the side of the road, in ghost towns, all of those now you could be arrested for. And I'm just talking about arrested. Prosecuted is another thing. And let me tell you what pushed me over the edge about telling you all this. I just watched a video on YouTube, and this is the story, this is one-sided, I'm only seeing the side of the person this happened to, and, you know, take it for whatever you want. Army veteran, driving a van with his wife and dog to Sturgis for the Sturgis rally, is towing a motorcycle behind it, drives all night, has a campground all set up in Sturgis, but stops at a city park as he gets into town because he needs a rest, and the dog's got to have a walk, and they decide to make breakfast. And it's like 7:30 in the morning, right? So it's not even nighttime or anything. And they get the knock. And the guy's like, oh, hello, officer, how can I help you? And the officer says, there's no camping here. The guy says, okay, officer, we're not camping. We just stopped on the way to the campground. Cop says, let me see some ID. Guy says, no, this is not a situation where I need to show you ID. I'm not going to do that. Cop says, it certainly is. Let me see some ID right now. You know how it goes from here. It escalates. They argue. Cop opens the door, grabs the guy, throws him to the ground violently, handcuffs him, drags him to his police car, and hauls him off to jail. The wife is there with the van and the dog, and he doesn't know what's happening to them because now the cops are interacting with her, and he spends the day in jail and is finally let out with a bunch of charges. Resisting arrest, obstruction, battery on a police officer, all these things, which he claims are all bogus, and I have no reason not to believe him. Okay, so we have that story, and I was going to share it with you, but the YouTube video got pulled down, and I don't know why. I don't know whether he decided to pull it down, or the content was too rough for YouTube, which seems unlikely. I don't know what the story is, but it's just a story. I can't verify anything, so just take that as a story. And the police might have a whole different story. You know, maybe he pointed a gun at them or something. I don't know. I doubt it. But look, let's look just at that story. What did he do wrong? What did he do that was illegal? What did he do that caused that situation to happen? Well, he was out in public. Okay, that's the first thing he did. He drew attention to himself just by being in a van in a public park. That's it. If he had pulled in there in a Prius, this interaction probably wouldn't have happened. And this thing, and this is the important thing, the cop asked for ID and he said no. This is the problem. In the United States, we have the Fourth Amendment, which means you don't have to show a cop your ID unless they suspect you of committing a crime. And since he wasn't committing a crime, they couldn't suspect him of committing one. And that's why he said no. And this changes based on a few things, but basically he was in the right to say no. There are times when that isn't true. I am not a lawyer. Do not take any legal advice from me. But what I've seen on many, 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 many videos, and I know some of them can be biased, is that once you say no to a cop, then you're in this ego fight. The cop is trained to maintain power over the situation at all times for officer safety. They are not there to have a conversation with you. They're not there to be convinced with you. They're there to get you to do what they want. And if the cop wants to see your ID, whether they're legally justified in demanding it or not, their training, which becomes instinct, kicks in and they will keep going, keep escalating until they get that ID from you in many cases. And that's what I think happened here. And I think that happens all the time. So the cop just kept going, and finally the cop went so far as to arrest the guy to get his ID, and then because he was arrested, there had to be charges, and their battery and obstruction are very easy charges. You know, if you touch a police officer, that's battery. If the police officer has handcuffed you, there's lots of opportunities for touch. This is why we have body cams, and that's a horrific situation. This guy didn't even sleep there. He just stopped there. And he's arrested. And this was a white guy, by the way. He's a veteran. And the reason he made the video is because he's going to fight this. He made all kinds of videos and recordings, and he totally intends to take this to court. And good for him. I wish him all the best. But again, the video's gone. But seeing that shows me that it's absolutely true that if people follow the advice I've given on this podcast, oh, these many years, they could get arrested. So I have to warn you about that. It's not safe out there in any circumstances, and it's especially not safe if you don't look white. This is not a political statement. This is a fact borne out by evidence, and you should know that. So I have a personal code for how I deal with the police. It is based on what I think is in my best interest. My advice to you is to come up with your own. It doesn't have to look like mine. You should make it tailored to your situation. But I will tell you what mine is, and then you can go from there, okay? Number one, very most important part of all of this, if a police officer asks for my ID, as long as I know they're a police officer, I will show them my ID. That's my personal policy. That is an easy thing for me to say because my ID is clean. When you give them your ID, they're going to run it to see if you have any warrants. I don't have any warrants, I don't think. If I do, that would be shocking. I have a very clean record. I really don't have anything to worry about there. That's not true for everybody. If you have anything on there, that makes them look further. You've got some shoplifting arrest from 30 years ago? Well, maybe we're going to look a little bit more. Like, ooh, has he got some plastic bags I can see through the back window? Did he pay for those things? Maybe that's probable cause. I mean, this is kind of what you have to worry about. So you may not decide to do that. But know that if you get into that ego fight with the cops, you could end up arrested just because the cop can't lose. Their ego won't let them lose. Number two, I will be as polite and terse as possible. I am going to just use as few words as possible and answer their questions as directly as possible. And I'm going to do it politely, and I'm going to very carefully listen to the words they're saying, not inferring any meaning. Do you have any ID? The answer is yes. The answer is not reach into your back pocket and give them the ID. The answer is yes. Make them say, can I see your ID? Then you have a choice, yes or no. If you say yes, then you hand them the ID. But if you say no, then you're in for the struggle, and you should be ready for that. Again, the rights might be on your side. I'm not talking about what the rights are. I'm just talking about you getting out of the situation safely, or me in this case. If they ask you where you're coming from, you can just simply to say, oh, I was down the road a bit. You can say whatever you want. They don't care where you're coming from. They're asking you questions to get you talking, to find a reason to arrest you or to investigate further. Try not to give them one. On my Aurora trips, I did not have any interactions with the police on any of my Aurora trips, which is, you know, it was a lot of miles, like 5,000 miles, no interactions with the police. But when I have been pulled over for speeding, well, I do have a weird strategy. I say stuff that is true and yet unbelievable. Don't do this. This is a bad strategy. This is a personality quirk of mine. When I'm under stress, I become extremely literal and offer way too much detail. That is bad. But I have done that with the police. And I've made it so that they're just tired of listening to me. They let me go. This is a terrible strategy, but it is something that has actually worked for me. Do not do this. You are not me. I don't know how I've gotten away with it, but I have. Anyway, no, be terse. Be terse. Where are you coming from? Oh, I was just at the supermarket. Something like that. I'm coming from a friend's house. Whatever. As short as you possibly can. If the conversation starts going in a direction that you don't like, you do have the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment. And you can say, officer, at this point, I would like to invoke my Fifth Amendment and stop answering your questions. At no point do you ever have to answer a police officer's question. Ever. You may have consequences for that. That may be enough for them to want to arrest you. But legally, you don't have to say a word to them unless you have a lawyer present and the lawyer advises you that it's okay to answer them. Again, you're in an ego fight with the cop. The cop has to win. And clamming up like that, you're balancing whether they're going to want to win so much that they will ignore the inconvenience that you're causing for them. Or maybe it's close to the end of their shift. They don't want to deal with the paperwork, you know, something like that. It's tricky. You're gambling either way, but it's good to have a policy so you don't have to think about it. You just do what the policy says. Do you mind if we search your vehicle? My answer to that is always yes. I will not allow anyone to search my vehicle. Why? Is it because I have things in there? I don't have anything in there that I ever think is a problem. But could there possibly be something in there? Maybe. Maybe I had a friend and they dropped a marijuana vape and I didn't notice it and it's under the seat of my car and I'm in a state where that's not legal. Could that have happened? Maybe. Maybe it's a used car and maybe somebody stashed their weed up in the dashboard and I didn't even know about it. I'm not going to present any opportunities for them to find stuff I don't know is there. So no searches. If they say they're going to have to call a canine, call the canine. I'm going to sit there and wait. And this will take time. If they're going to bring canines, you can expect to sit in your car for an hour. And then I'm going to record everything. Because there have been videos of the cops retraining the canines simply to mark that there are drugs because the cop did something. They've even got this thing where all the cops know this so much that they'll turn away so their body cameras don't see it. And then the next thing you see is, oh, the cop is indicated. Yeah. I don't know why they do this. Maybe they have quotas or something. I don't know. I don't like it. But that does happen. So no, I'm not going to help them search my vehicle. If they're going to search my vehicle, it's going to be because they've arrested me or they've got probable cause or something, because at that point, a court case is much, much, much more likely. And I want as much documentation and evidence as I can possibly gather. And if they indicate they're going to arrest me, I am going to do exactly what they say and become a dead fish and not make any movement or say anything at all. Once the cuffs come out, I am done. This has never happened to me, okay? I'm not speaking from experience. I just have to have a plan for if it does happen. Put your hands behind your back. As soon as I hear that, my hands are going behind my back, crossed in a way that makes it very easy for them to handcuff me. I'm going to let them do what they want. I'm not going to fight or struggle in any way. I'm going to walk along with them and get in the car, and I'm going to be completely silent. That is what I plan to do. I have been handcuffed, not by the police. It's a long, kind of a funny story, but I'm going to have to put it aside to just say, handcuffs are not comfortable. Know that handcuffs are not meant to be comfortable. They hurt, and you are going to be uncomfortable with them, and you will be in them longer if you struggle and fight, and you'll be racking up charges too. So just go along with it and let them get it over with. That is what my plan is. What I'm advising you is not to follow my plan. I'm advising you to follow your plan. What are you going to do? One of the most important things you can do is to make sure you have a way to notify someone that this has happened to you and make sure they know what to do if they get that call at 2 o'clock in the morning that says you've been arrested. For me, I have a whole bunch of people I can call and, you know, they'll take care of it right away. I mean, I've got a nice network of folks that will take care of things for me. Make sure you have someone too. This was not pleasant. I didn't like saying any of these things or recording these things. I like to focus on hitting the road and, you know, there's some of these rest areas are beautiful. Wisconsin has beautiful rest areas. You know, I've spent many, many nights at Wisconsin rest areas, some of them hiking trails, and loved it. I felt very comfortable there. I felt welcome. I mean, it says welcome on the door. But now I just don't feel that way. And I feel like I owe it to you guys not to feel the way I do or not to do the things I've said, but to just understand that it's not the way it was out there. There's a different reality now between citizens and police, and you have to take that into account when you hit the road. So, I'm happy to hear your comments on that if you'd like to. I don't like focusing on negative stuff like this, but I really just had to say that. So, time to move on. Special thank you to everyone who has donated at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. You folks are the reason there are no ads on this podcast, and everyone appreciates that. Thank you especially to the folks who donate every month. If you'd like to help out, you can visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go and buy me a gallon of whatever you want. You get to pick what the gallon is, and I will gladly accept it, and we will all thank you. Tech Talk. So what happens if your alternator dies? Can you keep driving? Well, for most people, the answer is almost no. Let's talk about technically what happens. The alternator in your car produces power, electrical power for your car. That's all it does. The engine turns and a belt turns around this device that has a bunch of coiled wires and magnets spinning, and that generates electricity for the car. That's how it works. And that electricity powers your lights and everything that's electronic in the car and also recharges your battery. Now, alternators wear out, belts break. There are times when your alternator just stops working. And weirdly to me, some vehicles don't even tell you this. Like, my Sprinter doesn't have a light that says the alternator has stopped working, which I find bizarre. Or maybe mine just burned out. I've never seen a vehicle that didn't have a light. You know, it's usually a picture of a battery that comes up that says something's wrong. At least when the battery starts getting low. But in my Sprinter, nothing. The battery it will not tell you anything. Anyway, we'll talk more about the Sprinter in a minute. But it made me think about this. We have an interesting situation in camper vans because the alternator is not actually necessary for the vehicle to keep going. What's necessary is the power it produces. And when we're in a van with a leisure battery and maybe some power banks and stuff, we've got a lot of power. All we need to do is get it to the right place. So if you're in an emergency situation where your alternator has died, you're going to be able to drive for a bit until your battery gets too weak to power everything, which can happen pretty quickly. If you're ever in that situation, turn off everything you possibly can. Turn off the stereo, turn off the air conditioning, all the fans, everything you possibly can. You're still going to be using electricity. Your spark plugs still use electricity, or, you know, depends on what kind of car you have, or truck or van. You're still going to be using electricity. Your battery is still going to die, and that's going to kill your vehicle. But turning everything off will help. However, if you're clever, you can actually jump your other batteries to the starter battery, and that can keep you going longer. I know a lot of people in Winnebagos have done this, because Winnebagos, the old classic Winnebagos like the one I have, the alternators go all the time because these things are 50 years old. And what people do is they run 12 volts from the leisure battery to the starter battery. Now, it's really easy to do in the Winnebago. There's a switch for it on the dashboard. It's very easy. Or if you look underneath, the leisure batteries and the starter batteries are actually on a tray right next to each other, so you could just wire them together. You might have a little harder time if your batteries are in the back, but the concept is there. You can take the 12 volts from the leisure battery and apply it to your starter battery, and that will keep you going. Now, you don't want to do this very long. You're still draining power, but you could maybe extend your trip from 10 miles to 100 miles if you had to, and that might help. Definitely take it easy. Don't use more power than you have to, and vehicles will act differently depending on... your experience may be different depending on what kind of a vehicle you have. More and more vehicles have electric steering now. My NV200 had that, for example. And then if your alternator goes, the steering could also go too. So this is not a safe thing to do. It's still an emergency situation. So you want to do this to limp along to get to where you need to go. But it is nice to have that option. It's a perk of van life that you have all this excess battery capacity that you can use just to keep going down the road if you have to. Product review. And this device will help you. So I talk about multimeters a lot. It's one of the essential things you need if you're building out a van. And a multimeter is just this little yellow, orange, or red box that has two wires coming out of it, and you use it to detect voltage or amperage or resistance. It's basically an electronic... If you've seen Star Trek, it's like a tricorder for electric things, basically. And I've used these things for 40 years now, I think. And I will admit to you, I have never learned how they work entirely. I mean, I know how to do the basic things I need to do, but they've got like 900 functions. And if you don't know the symbols of electricity, you may not know how to use the stupid things. For example, if you don't know what the omega symbol means, some of these are going to be impossible to use. The omega symbol is a symbol for ohms, which is the measurement of resistance, which is how you test continuity. And if all that confused you, I understand why. You need to have a decent amount of education to understand how to use one of these multimeters. So Hal found this one that you don't need to know anything. It doesn't have any settings on it. It's like... You know, it's kind of funny. It's a smart multimeter, but it's also a dumb multimeter. And I will explain. I have a link in the show notes, of course. But the point of this thing is, you don't have to set anything. You just do what you want to do, and it will tell you. For example, it's got two wires, a red one and a black one. If you put the red one on the positive side and the black one on the negative side, it will tell you the voltage, because that's probably what you want to do. If you put the leads in between a circuit, for example, you attach the black one to a light bulb and the red one to the power on the battery, it will tell you the amperage or the draw. And if you connect it to two pieces of a wire, it'll tell you if the wire has any breaks in it. It just knows what you want to do. And it's not that it's smarter reading your mind. It's just that it senses voltage, amperage, and resistance all at the same time. And then if it doesn't detect any voltage or amperage, it will show you resistance. Or if it detects a lot of amperage, it'll show you that. Or if it detects a lot of voltage, it's just figuring out. It's just like a chart. It's a giant if-then statement. That's how this thing works. But it does work. It's dead. If you are not familiar with electrical stuff and you don't want to take the time to really learn how to use a proper multimeter, this thing is probably what you should have. Plus, it has another thing that none of my multimeters have, which is called an NCV, which has nothing to do with the NCV3, which is the kind of sprinter I had. NCV is non-contact voltage. There's a little nubbin at the top of this thing, and it detects electricity. It's not all that great at it. It's not like it's not going to tell you how many volts or anything, but it'll tell you if there's electricity there. So for example, if you're trying to trace the wires from a switch, you can turn the circuit on and then hold this nubbin by the switch and it will make noise. And then you can just move along the wall, and as long as it keeps making noise, you're following the wire. Or you can tell if a wire's energized before you disconnect it. For example, let's say you've got this giant cable that goes from your battery to your DC to DC charger, and you're not sure if there's power there. Well, just run this thing along it. And if it doesn't beep, there probably isn't power there. It's kind of how do you trust a negative? You know, you still want to be careful. But it would definitely beep if it detected power, and then you would know you shouldn't do anything just yet. It's $16. It's not even. It's $15. Right now, it's on sale. I mean, I'm going to keep this. Even though I've got all these other multimeters, this one's so dead simple that that's what I'm going to use most of the time now, I think. It's very small, and it actually feels like an old cell phone, but much lighter. I mean, it easily fit in your pocket. My only complaint about it is that you can't detach the cables. If you were doing just voltage detection, just seeing which circuits are live, you don't need the cables at all. You don't use them at all for that. But you still have to kind of hold on to them, and they're, you know, stabby. So I kind of wish the cables could get disconnected. And also, if you damage the cables, you're kind of in trouble. You have to take the whole thing apart to repair it. But for $16 or $15, you're probably just going to buy a new one. Another thing I don't like about it is that you have to recharge it. Some multimeters have batteries, some don't. This one does, and they put in a rechargeable battery. And while you might think, well, that's great, you don't have to buy batteries, it also means that it can die on you, and then you have to wait to charge it. If you're just throwing in AA batteries, you'll have it again instantly, and that can be a problem. Rechargeable batteries aren't always the best solution, and that's one of those cases. But it's fine. It's got a color LCD screen. I mean, it looks so much more advanced than the old school ones. It's kind of funny. But remember I said it was dumb? This thing will not do anywhere near the sophisticated tests that a proper Fluke multimeter will do. So this is not a tool for an electrician or anybody like that. But for somebody building a van, I think this thing will probably do almost everything you could want it to do. And even if you already have a multimeter, this would be a great thing just to throw in your glove box or whatever, just for those quick tests, like checking to see if fuses are still good or whatever, which you do with continuity. So the brand name, which is listed way in the fine print, is NJTY. No idea what that stands for. Digital multimeter, weighs 150 grams, and it's $15.19, and I will have a link in the show notes, and I'm happy with it. So thanks, Hal. You were 100% correct, and I'm glad you found this thing. Tales from the Road. This is an unfinished tale, but I'm going to tell it now because it's happening now. The Sprinter. We're going to still talk about the Sprinter. Some of you on Facebook and in the Discord group may have noticed that I was posting pictures of the Sprinter being all empty. And I've got two quick stories about this. The first is that you learn about van life when you take apart a van as well as when you build a van. And I did not expect that. As I was taking the van apart, I removed the sink and the battery and the fan and some lights and, you know, stuff I was going to reuse in my new build. I learned some things. For example, I saw where there was some wear I didn't know about that was happening, and I saw that some of the ways I connected things wasn't ideal, and I came away with this appreciation of the process that this was actually not ending a van life journey. This was part of it, and it was like a reckoning of all this work I put into this van, what happened to it, what survived, what didn't, what worked, and what didn't. And I took mental stock of all that. And that was actually super useful, and it kind of cheered me up a little bit. I mean, this was a miserable process. I just spent years building this van, and it was my favorite thing. Of all my objects that I possessed, except for maybe my phone, this thing was my favorite thing. And, you know, I was taking it apart. You know, I felt like I was betraying it. But using it as a learning experience, I was like, wow, okay, I see how I can do this differently and make it better. Or, in some cases, I was like, that really held up well. That was a really good solution for that. So, if you are in this situation where you have to empty out a van like that, try to take that attitude. Try to take the attitude that this is a learning part that's going to make your next build better. And, you know, I did have some few trips down memory road that were kind of pleasant. And there were some that weren't so pleasant. You know, remembering how much time I spent removing the brackets for the stretcher. Ugh. See, now I'm sad again. No, I'm not. No, I'm happy to be done with that problem. That's where I am. And speaking of that, what I decided to do, as I mentioned, was I was going to donate the van to NPR. And if you listen to NPR at all, they said, you know, the guy from Car Talk comes on and says, hey, donate your van, and, you know, or your car or your truck. Doesn't matter if it runs. Well, this turned out to be more difficult than I thought. My idea was I would call them and say, hey, come get the van. And they would say, sure. And they would come get the van, and that would be the end of it. No, no, it's much more complicated than that. Obviously, NPR isn't doing this themselves. They've contracted with a company to do it. And the company, well, I think they're on the up and up, but it was just a little odd. Their instructions say that before they even come, you should fill out the title and sign it over to them. And then, like, step 7 in the process was you send them all this information, which I did. And then they wrote back and said, we don't think we want your van. You can see the problem there. Had I followed their instructions, which I didn't, I would have already signed over the title to them, only to have them say they don't want the van. That's a problem, because then I'd need to go get a new title, or I'd need to find them and have them sign it back over to me. Yuck. So I'm glad I didn't follow that advice. But they were really iffy about the van, and they asked me what I thought it was worth, and I was like, isn't that your job? And they said, well, what do you think about $500? And I was like, $500? I'm pretty sure it's worth more than that in scrap. So I went to Kelly Blue Book and looked up the value of the van. I picked the worst possible condition since the van kind of only sort of runs. And it came back with $7,000. So I said, all right, $7,000. And they said that what they did, this is interesting, they put it up for auction without actually having possession of the van. And they came back with an offer of $1,100. And I've just had a sip of Dead Man's Whiskey in honor of that $1,100 offer. I said, let me think about it. Because at that point, I'm like, well, is this even worth it? Because it's not like NPR gets that whole $1,100. They write a receipt for $1,100, and then they take expenses off of it, such as the tow, which they can charge whatever they want for, and then fees and whatever. And NPR gets somewhere between 70 and 80% from my research. That might not even be true. NPR's not getting that much money out of this, but somebody is, because I know that van is worth more than that. At some point, it's going to be parted out or whatever, and somebody's going to make significantly more than $1,100 from a van that has no body damage and an engine that can be saved, and, you know, even the wheels and tires could be worth more than that. So I was like, well, if I'm going to have to go through this, why don't I just do this? And I spur of the moment, I stuck it up on Facebook Marketplace for $2,000 just to see what would happen. I looked around and there were a bunch of NCV Sprinters being parted out and stuff. And I was like, yeah, what the heck? Let's just see. All right. Then here's what happened. First 10 minutes, I had 12 people trying to buy the van. 12. And Facebook Marketplace is full of scams. And I'm looking like, okay, that's a scam, that's a scam. And the classic thing, I tried to be very specific in the description. It's this year, it's this many miles, everything. And somebody like basically asking me every single question that's answered in the description. And finally, after two questions that I knew were like in the title, I said, go read the description. And they went away, which is interesting. A lot of scams out there. And then one of them caught my eye. It was somebody who wanted to turn it into a camper van. I was like, oh no, here we go. And I'm like, I explained to the guy, I was like, look, I'm a van life guy. I don't think this vehicle is very good for somebody who wants to go van lifing in it unless they're a mechanic. And he said, well, my brother's a mechanic. And so I ended up talking to the guy's brother on the phone. Unfortunately, there was a language barrier, so I'm not sure how much of it got through. But he basically said, after I told him everything that was wrong, he said that he thought he could help his brother fix it and that it would be fine. And I think if that's the case, this is a great deal for $2,000. You're getting a good basis for a camper van. It's not a camper van now. I've removed too much of it. It's a cargo van with cabinets now. But, okay, I hope it works out. So we're supposed to do that this weekend. I don't know if it's going to work out, but I will let you know how that story goes, because I know at some point you and your van are going to part, and it may go this route. So at this point, I can get $2,000 for it, and if, you know, I could just donate that to NPR. They get a lot more money than if I dealt with this company that is handling their vehicles. I mean, I don't really understand how it all works, but what they say in the ads isn't really what happens. And if you are ever doing this, do not sign your title over until they are on site and taking the vehicle. Because if you sign that title over, it's legally theirs. And you don't want to be in that situation. They need a bill of sale too, but still, don't sign the title. It's a pain in the ass document to begin with. A place to visit. Given everything else we've talked about in this rather negative episode, I want you to do something for me. At some point, I want you to go someplace that you don't know where you're going. And a fun way to do that is to pick a word. Pick a word. I did this Aurora project kind of like this, but before I did the Aurora project, I also did the Moon project, except it wasn't a project. I knew I had to drive to Texas, and I knew I wanted to find something to break up the trip between Chicago and Texas, and I hadn't explored Oklahoma that much, so I was like, I'm going to go to Oklahoma. I'm going to go to a place just based on a word. I'm going to look at the map and find an interesting word, and that's where I'm going. I don't care about anything else, just the word. And I ended up going to Moon, Oklahoma, M-O-O-N, Moon, Oklahoma. And that's a whole big, long story. And it's kind of an interesting story. But I'm not going to tell you the story, because I want you to make your own story by doing the same thing. This does things for you. Not only does it give you a story, it gives you perspective. And it sets your mind in a way that you're not looking for a thing, you're looking at everything. You have found the destination, you don't know why you're there, so you're taking everything in. You're noticing everything, because there's a story here, and you're looking to create it, and your mind will now be open to everything that's around you. You'll notice so much more. You know, if you're driving to Disney World or whatever, you're just looking at the map. There's Disney World. How many more miles to Disney World? You know, it's Disney World. But if you're just driving to the name of a place, you've got no preconceptions. You've got no idea what you're going to see, and because of that, you're going to see everything. I had a weird, fun, kind of creepy experience in Moon, Oklahoma, and that is permanently a part of me. And I'm very glad that I had that. And Moon, Oklahoma, is not special, or at least not any more special than any other place you could go. So think about that sometime. And it can only take a day. You can set whatever criteria you want. And you don't have to pick a word. You can use a dart if you want. You can do whatever. The point is to be random and to pick a place that does not have a set destination for you. It is a wonderful experience. I think I did it by myself. I think it could be fun if you did it with another person. Maybe one of you is a photographer and the other one is a writer. Or maybe you're going to do a podcast or whatever. Maybe you're going to pick flowers. Maybe your goal is that you're going to go to this place and you're going to pick up what you find there, foliage-wise, or even like roadside debris or whatever, and you're going to make something out of it. Or maybe you're going to leave something. Maybe you've made a birdhouse and you're going to go to this place and leave that birdhouse. Whatever, you get to make the rules. But by doing this, you will change the way your mind works, at least for that time, and you will be in observational mode rather than target mode. And you might say it's the scout mindset, if you've read Julia Galef's book. And that can be so very, very valuable, especially in these times we're living in now. If you do this, and you're interested, let me know. Let me take that story and put it on the podcast. You can record it yourself, you can send me words, and I will talk for you, whatever the heck you'd like. But I think we could get some really cool stories out of this, and start to get back a bit more to the joys of van life, and not all this practical stuff that keeps getting in the way. Resource recommendation. Okay, here's one that's out there. Burning Man, a place that I have not been to, but I would like to go to someday. They have a no gray water policy. I mean, obviously you're going to make gray water, but you can't just dump it out on the playa. That would be bad for the ecosystem. It would create mud and everything, and you're not allowed to do it. And they're very strict about it. But some folks are out there for a long time, and they generate a lot of gray water, and it's weight, and they don't really know what to do with it, and they don't want to haul it back. So they've developed these gray water evaporation systems. And it's an interesting idea if you're in an arid environment. And basically, they will reduce the quantity of their gray water. They concentrate it so it's much easier to haul out. And some of them have been very creative in what they've done. Some of them basically have like a dog pool, and they'll pour the water out there and just let the sun evaporate it. Others have developed mechanisms that kind of are like a reverse swamp cooler, where the sheets will dip in the water and then go back up, and the wind and the heat from the sun will evaporate the water. Anyway, I don't know that any of this is practical for daily van life, but it's an interesting thing to think about, and I thought I'd share that with you. And it's just a Reddit thread. This is not like, here's the solution to this problem. No. This is an introduction to a discussion about how one might solve this problem. So I will have a link in the show notes to the Reddit thread, but it's actually in the Burning Man Reddit. And the Burning Man people are very creative, clever folks. And the fact that they have this problem is something that we might be able to learn from. So that's my invitation to you. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 276. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And yes, it's true, we do have a Facebook group and a Discord server. And you may find both of those in the show notes or at builttogo.com. Until next time, remember the words of Marilyn Vos Savant, most intelligent person in the world, who said, "To acquire knowledge, one must study, but to acquire wisdom, one must observe."